Hello and welcome to Outside In. I'm John Burns, and this is my podcast for outdoor folk who are spending their time indoors at the moment. My guest today has written a book about something that's very special to all of us, I think. I think he's captured something. His book is called The Weekend Fix, and I know for me that throughout my life, the weekends have always been very special, and getting away into the hills or climbing crags has been my release and kept me, well, I wouldn't say it's kept me sane. that would perhaps be stretching it a bit, but it kept me as sane as I am. How's that? But recently, that outlet for the last year has been closed to many of us. So I think through his book, maybe we can experience that anew and sort of charge ourselves up for hopefully when things get a bit back to normal. My guest today is Craig Weldon, whose book The Weekend Fix is released today. Hello, Craig. How are you doing?
Hi, John. Yeah, pretty good today. I'm excited about the book launch and everything. Just good timing with the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. This is your podcast launch, isn't it, really?
I think it's the first podcast I've ever done, so that's also very exciting.
Well, there you go. Cool. Well, you're really in the big league now, Yeah. I mean, several people will listen to this. Tell me a little bit about your book. I mean, what first of all, what got you into mountaineering? First of all, because you're based in Bonnyrigg near Edinburgh at the moment. But where did you start exploring the Scottish hills?
Well, for me, it started in childhood. I grew up in the west coast of Scotland, a town called Helensburgh, which is right on the edge of the Highlands. And I had a granny who lived in the Highlands in Dunoon, so we would drive past Arriker and over the rest and be thankful and down through Cowell and with all these sort of mountains and things around, and they all seemed a bit they're quite exciting to see. It's like, wow, wouldn't it be good to go up there one day? And I would sit in my classroom as a schoolboy looking out of the window rather than concentrating on the class, but that you could see the hills from my school. And I'd be like, I wonder what it'd be like to go up there. And one day I did. I wasn't allowed to climb the hills. I didn't know anybody else who was interested. In those days, boys were interested in football and that kind of thing. So I just went off myself, went out on my bike, didn't tell anyone I was going, climbed this hill. And from the top, just in Glenfruin near Helensburgh, and from the top you could see just waves of hills just unfurled. Mm-hmm. And I was just hooked from that point. There's Ben Lomond that I could recognize, but there's so many other hills. I was like, wow, I'd like to go over there. I'd like to climb that hill. And that's kind of how it started, really. I didn't do much walking at that point, but as soon as I could, as soon as I was basically a student, that was me off.
Yeah, you mentioned something there. I think that I can recall the first time that I came to the Highlands. I would have been a bit older than you. I wasn't a schoolboy, but I was, I suppose I was at university at the time. But what got me was or what inspired me very much was when you climb a hill in the Highlands, and that sense almost that there is an endless vista of hills rolling away in the distance, and the opportunities that gives you. So when you got to university, obviously, presumably then, yeah, you became a bit more serious about what you were doing. Is that right?
Well, it was, yeah. And what you're saying there about the vista, it's so true. Like when I moved to Birmingham for a while, and climbing some of the hills around there, what are those ones? Not the Mendips, the Malvern Hills, you could see all the way to like the Chilterns, Moulting London, and down to the Cotswolds, and then across to the Shropshire Hills, the Welsh Boards. It's like, wow, you could just see so far, and it's like, I want to go up there, I want to go over there. But anyway, back to your question. Yeah, I did university for me. It was a bit of a 4-year gap between having to face reality, to be honest, and it was the most important thing for me was to get a university near the hills. So I chose Glasgow It's closest university to lots and lots of hills. It did mean that I stayed at home because it's commutable from Helensburgh. It's right. Pretty close. That was me. Sort of my weekends were filled with hill walking when I could.
And did you join? Was there a club at university then?
There was, yes, yeah. Glasgow's great for the social side. There's a lot of different clubs, and I joined a lot to start with. Music club I joined, various other ones, but the mountaineering club, the Gum Club, they call it, Glasgow University Mountaineering Club, was a big influence in my sort of development of as a hill walker and an outdoorsman. I did try rock climbing and discovered I was absolutely terrified doing that, so that didn't go very far. But the hill walking and the Munro bagging, as it turned out to be quite a lot of Munro bagging, that really gripped me.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. What got you into writing about the hills? Because that's a very different thing, isn't it?
It certainly is, yes. I've always liked doing a bit of creative writing. But what got me into writing this particularly, well, two things. Back in the late 90s, I actually worked offshore. I was based in Aberdeen and had a job as an ROV pilot technician. So what most offshore guys do, certainly young single offshore guys do, is they come home for a few weeks and they go to the pub. And that just wasn't really, it didn't seem to be a good use of time. All my friends, like my hill walking friends, were available at weekends, but they weren't available during the week. So I would actually go out and I'd drive around and I'd see places, I'd climb hills, I'd take photographs for a website. And I started actually writing for this website, which ended up being a blog called Love of Scotland.
Ah, right. Okay.
So that's kind of basically where the writing started. And it wasn't planned as a book or anything, but one day I was speaking to someone and she said, you know, you're always going about these hills. You should write a guidebook. So, oh, all right, I'll do that. I had a different job at that point. I was working shifts and I would have the days free. So I thought, well, I could use that to fill my days. So I started writing a book, but it ended up not being a guidebook. It was more basically my experiences going up the hills. And it eventually evolved over a few years. It became this book, The Weekend Fix.
Right. So, and what really stands out to you then about the events that you wrote about in the book? Well, if you had to pull out a few highlights, what would they be?
One of the main themes in it is kind of the companionship and kind of the friendships that you make up the hills. Another thing that actually I think is quite important is it's quite real. A lot of things that you read, it's always a beautiful sunny day, people are having an epic time. But yeah. that's not, we know that's not reality.
No,
all the time,
definitely
all the time.
Not.
And I was looking through my book just recently. I was looking through it. And I thought there's an awful lot of descriptions of wet, windy weather, and with the occasional bit where I'm actually not very happy.
Disasters.
So that's quite realistic, I think.
Yeah. That's right. I mean, if you're in the Scottish Hills, you'll spend most of your time wet for a fair amount of the time anyway. I certainly seem to manage that anyway. And of course, disasters are much easier to write about than successes. But you mentioned the sort of the friendships and the people that you meet. Mm-hmm. Are there particular people that you've always gone to the hills with, or has that changed a lot, do you think?
Well, I think when you do something, now I know that hill walking, it's not really as hardcore as some other things you can do. Mm-hmm. But I think when you do things that kind of push you a bit and you do it with a group of friends, you can make some really strong friendships.
Absolutely.
When you're doing these sort of activities. And so some of the friends that I made when I was at uni, they became, lifelong friends. So very close friends. And the sort of group that I went together with, would I say they were more charactery than your average? They might well be, that's possible. but yeah, and part of that, I think, is just having these sort of adventures.
Oh, no, I think you're right. I mean, I think if you if you face adversity together, if you lost on the plateau of the Cairngorms in a blizzard together, those sort of things bond you without a doubt, I think. I think that's certainly true. So we're talking about how important your weekends and your breaks on the hills were to you, and obviously over the last year or so we've kind of not been able to do that. How have you found lockdown? How has that been for you?
It's been tough, but it's also not. It could be a lot worse. So my personal circumstance. Employment's not been an issue, so that's been a massive thing not to worry about that I know a lot of people have had to worry about. I got injured at the end of 2019.
And all right, what happened to you?
I'm not going to bore your listeners with my medical history, but it was basically a kind of sciatica, kind of weak quads and sore arse and a dodgy knee.
Oh yeah, that sounds like me most of the time. Yeah.
Oh right. Yeah. Well, I do a lot of stretching. I was talking to a guy who used to play rugby at high level, and he said, mate, when the stretching takes longer than the game, that's time to quit.
And that's very true.
But fortunately, it takes he'll walk last all day. So and. Unless I've got to stretch all day, I'll still be climbing hills. So I got injured. So there's a lot of things I couldn't have really done anyway. I also play and referee touch rugby, which is it's more social, like tag rugby, some people call it. There's no tackles or anything, but I couldn't do that. Couldn't really do hills the way I could previously. And then lockdown came, so it's like, okay. That's just the situation we're in. But I think what really saved the situation for us was we've always had a sort of an appreciation of nature. Mm-hmm. That's always been there anyway. But now we were forced to basically just look at what was around us.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
To take pleasure in what might be the smaller things. So just really enjoying watching the birds in the bird bath in the garden.
Yeah.
Going out for walks in the woods, and we actually found that there's a few local walks around here that people do. There's a cycleway that gets really busy with dog walkers and cyclists and people just out walking, and especially at the first lockdown, it got really, really busy, and we're like, ooh, should we be so close to so many people? And we found some other walks nearby that were just gorgeous that we just didn't know about because we hadn't explored the local area. And I think that that's probably hopefully happened for a lot of people, just really appreciating the local what's on offer. And so basically during the first lockdown, we just really enjoyed spring happening. We were going back and back to this place which had this sort of bit of forest, so listening to the birds and watching the the wood anemones coming up, and then the bluebells, and then the leaves coming out in the trees, and then we were foraging for dyeing materials, for making vegetable dyes.
Oh right, yes,
so doing that kind of stuff.
I thought you meant things that were dying, right? Okay, I've
no. got you. Yeah, and just really doing that. Now, separately, I also got into something. Have you ever heard of the tumps?
No.
Right. Oh, right. Well, I'm not too surprised. You've heard, the Munros.
I know the Munros.
And
yes.
There's the Munros and there's the Corbetts.
Yeah.
In the Lake District, there's the Wainwrights.
Oh yeah.
Then we start getting a bit more obscure. You've got the Nuttalls.
Yeah, yeah. Donalds.
You've got Donalds. You've got the Marilyns.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
So that's kind of as basically far as I would normally go. So the Marilyns are any height with a 500-foot drop all round is a Marilyn.
Right, right, okay, okay.
And there's like 1,500 of them in Britain, I think, roughly.
Oh, wow.
Well, 1,554, I think. But
he knows exactly how many there are.
but the tumps, they're every every height with a drop all round of 100 foot or 30 metres.
Oh my God, there must be thousands of them.
There's about 17,000 in Britain.
Wow. You're not into those, are you?
It's locked down. You needs must. So,
fair enough.
So we're not allowed out of the county. Haven't been for ages.
Yes.
So I started bagging the local tubs.
Oh dear.
Which it seems desperate. It's the kind of hill walking equivalent of, skip diving for used alcohol bottles to get the dregs out of the bottom. You know,
it sounds like that. Yeah. I have to say, my views on ticking the Munros are well known and much despised. I have to say, but the Tump sounds like you. It really does sound like you got it pretty bad. But then again, what you're saying is right, because what we had to somehow make something out of what we had left during lockdown. And I know exactly what you mean when you talk about noticing the nature all around you. I live in a flat and overlook the River Ness, and outside of one of my windows there's a tree, and because I'm about four floors up or something, I look out into the branches of that tree. And I can well remember, last year in the first stages of lockdown, I would spend hours watching the birds there. We get quite a lot of blue tits and coal tits and all that sort of stuff. And watching them was the only connection with nature I had. And then I vividly remember last year when we came out of lockdown and I could suddenly travel, I went out into the hills. About 40 miles from Inverness. And what, of course, I hadn't, this was June, July, I think, by that stage. And I hadn't been in the hills since February or March. And what amazed me was I'd left the hills in winter in those sort of gray, brown and sort of autumnal hues. And when I came back, there had been a massive green explosion. The whole place had exploded into growth. It was quite incredible. So, like you, I had to find some way of exploring the River Ness that I look on and walking up and down that and seeing ducks and birds and house martins and stuff like that gave us some contact with nature.
Do you have otters in the Ness there?
Yes. Oh, yes. There's otters. They can be quite cheeky otters, they'll pop up and they know fine well you can't get them if they're in the water. So sometimes they'll come on and look at us. There was a big dog otter that lived just opposite my house for a while. He seems to have moved away, but I'm sure he's still there, really. He just hasn't popped up for a while, I think otters are making quite a return to our cities. I think there was an otter quite recently in the waters of Leith, wasn't there, in Edinburgh?
Right.
In the town centre, people were filming it, and I think it's partly because we've reduced the pollution in our water.
Oh, do you know what, there's an otter. When September last year, 2020, my wife and I, we went and we did something I called the Seven Hills of Arthur's Seat. So there's basically seven little bumps.
Okay.
And as we're going from coming down one towards the last one called Dunsappy, there's a little body of water, really not big at all, called Dunsappy Loch. And there's an otter in it in bright, in full daylight. It was really, really surprising to see. It was incredible.
That's
still
incredible.
Still there, apparently.
Yeah. I mean, I find that as part of research from my most recent book, Wild Winter, I went hunting for otters to try and sort of watch them on the West Coast, and spent several very cold days sitting, staring at water, seeing absolutely nothing. And then when I came back home to Inverness, an otter popped its head up out of the nest. I think they were just taking the piss, basically. You have to say that, don't you?
Never work with children, wildlife. Is that what they say?
Absolutely. I have incredible admiration for people who are wildlife photographers. I don't know how they have that kind of patience. I really don't. Mm-hmm. But I'm fortunate because I live in the Highlands, and although I haven't been traveling very far, technically now I could travel a couple of hundred miles and still be within my local authority.
Yeah. Although, well, if you wanted to bag the Tumps, there's 4,500 of them in the Highlands alone.
Is that right? I think I might leave them alone, you know.
Yeah.
That level of obsession hasn't quite reached me yet. But I'm hoping, you know, one of the big things, you know, I'm hoping that we'll be able to stay overnight fairly soon. Because one of the good things I really like is to, you know, visit Bothies, and or I've got myself a hot tent and go camping out in that, you know. Are there places that you stay when you're able to? What particular places do you go to?
Well, it's sort of changed over time, but certainly in the kind of period where the weekend fix is set, I used to love going up camping. We'd camp outside the King's House Hotel in Glencoe,
partly
the reason was because I had a friend who actually worked there behind the bar, but also lots of Bothies up the west coast. You know, like in Noida or even way up in Sutherland.
There
was sort of big favorites. We would
which Bothies?
I wasn't the best camper. We'd often drive somewhere and then just roll the seats of the car back and
that's as good as any.
I used to do that a lot, in fact. But nowadays I'm a bit older. I like my comforts more, so I've got a blow up mat and a sort of little tent. Camping expedition was up at Achnahaird. Do you know that part of the world? It's Achiltibuie, just south of Edinburgh.
Okay. Yeah, I know where that is. Yeah.
So there used to be this really lovely, very basic campsite. There's no showers or anything, just a toilet and a water stout. And it was just next to this just gorgeous beach with these beautiful dunes.
Shiegra, is it? Something like that. I might have got it wrong. It's something like that anyway. That's what I'm looking forward to, certainly, to getting away to places like that. Of course I'm with a hot tent I can be a sort of more like a portable bothy, really.
what's a hot tent? That's new to me.
Oh, you know, I heard of a hot tent. I've got a 10 teepee Sapphire 7, which is it's basically like a teepee. And what it is it's an old-fashioned style of tent, and it's if you can imagine a conical-shaped teepee, and inside, I mean, this is a big tent, you can stand up in it, and the reason it's hot is it's got its own wood-burning stove, and which with a chimney that comes out the top of the tent, so you can sit there in beside your stove. They are incredibly comfortable, incredibly warm, because I've sat there in minus 10 and been totally comfortable. How it'll withstand the Highland midge, it remains to be seen. But the purpose of me getting a hot tent really was because I don't know when we're going to be able to get back into Bothies. Unfortunately, it almost kind of feels like I wrote Bothy Tales and I may have been writing unknowingly about, hopefully not, but I may have been writing unknowingly about a culture that was actually on its way out at the time I wrote about it. I don't know, because of the virus and the various risks, are we ever going to be in a situation where, you know, you could get in, it's safe to go into a little dark bothy and sit very close to people who you don't know in conditions where it's impossible to have relatively reasonable hygiene. You know, I'm hoping that I'm wrong, but so I invested in the hot tent, which effectively means I can camp throughout the winter in relative comfort.
That's interesting. While you were talking, I looked that up, and it looks amazing.
Oh, it is.
You can always have a sauna or something in there and like run out, swim in the river and then jump back in your tent.
If you wanted to, you could, to be honest. Yeah, the stove, there's quite a big stove, and the problem with the stove is not getting heat out of it, it's trying to stop it melting the place, you know, because it just wants to roar away. But yeah. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, it's you know, obviously it's not the most portable of things, but I'm finding ways of transporting it, and I suppose
just yourself,
mostly just me. Yeah. Right, well, no, okay. No one wants to be with me. Mainly just me at the moment. But yeah, I'm hoping to have mates along in time. You know, because obviously it's difficult to when things move up. You know, I think we are more open. You know, I think it will be something I can share with other people.
So I was interested in something you said there. Do you think bothy mongering's on its way out?
I don't know. I think the risks, certainly because of the virus, I think may mean that there are far fewer people willing to go to a bothy. The great thing with a bothy, you know, a fantastic place. I've been visiting them for God knows years, but obviously the issue is you have no idea who else is going to be there, and if you're worried about transmitting the virus, then a bothy is probably the last place you'd want to be, and that might have a hangover for a long time.
Yeah, it could know. Well do.
I don't.
They're
know.
Not. They're not especially hygienic places, bothies.
No, well, it's difficult to heat water. It's difficult to keep them clean. It's difficult, and they're small, and they're places where, you know, they're damp and they're cold, and that's kind of ideal conditions for the virus to hang around. So I hope I'm wrong, but I just decided, well, I've kind of got to adapt. You know, I've kind of got to find a way of doing what I want. It won't be what I, you know, won't be ideal, but it'll allow me to go to wild places and to be, you know, in situations where I wouldn't otherwise be. and the hot tent, you know, is pretty safe from that point of view.
I've often wondered if, you know, Scotland would go the way of maybe some of the more continental countries with, you know, like mountain shelters that are staffed.
Well,
you know, like more basic than hostels, but you know, and out in remote places.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if you've ever been to an alpine climbing hut, but basically they did in the past stuff as many people as you could physically get into these places. You were almost sleeping on top of each other, and these were people from all in the Alps, from different nationalities, from all over the place. I really can't see that happening in the future.
Right,
you know, because
I've been ones in New Zealand.
Oh right, okay.
So yeah, I know what you mean.
Before you go, you mentioned your music, and I did listen to one of your songs about people with computers in their head. Which sounded a bit like Terminator if Arnold Schwarzenegger had come from Bonnie Rig, I thought. Well, how important is music in your life then?
Not at all.
Fair enough.
it was a big part of my life. It was, and I set up a little music studio, just a small one, kind of portable.
Yeah.
And I wanted to record bands. I recorded myself as well.
Yeah.
Wasn't very successful. But I started gigging myself and recording my own music. So that one that you listened to, the people with computers in their head, that was played on Radio 1 years ago.
Oh wow!
And a couple of other songs I did were also played on the radio. Sort of other people's stuff, but yeah, it didn't really go anywhere. And I think part of the reason is because I don't particularly enjoy gigging. Right. And I think you have to really love that whole lifestyle.
Yes.
For me, it was just a means to an end to actually get my music out there.
Right.
And also, I think there's a point where you, I think especially in music, in pop music anyway, where when you're young and you've got all these ideas and you're writing your stuff, but it kind of goes away a bit. You know, like almost any artist you can think of, they were probably best when they were younger.
Music by and large is a young person's game, isn't it? Yeah. Oh, well, I'll put it. Well, I quite enjoyed people with computers in their heads. So I just wondered if you wandered the hills with your earbuds in listening to that. I can understand that.
It is something that I do know one or two other people who were really into music and really into hill walking. It's quite an unusual combination. Maybe folk are into folk music, but not weird electronic stuff or. And I used to help run a gig night actually in Edinburgh back in the mid 2000s. God, that seems ages ago now. Wow.
Yeah, I know. It's weird how time flies. Yeah. Well, that's great. Well, as I say, you know, I'll put a wee link to that on the podcast page.
Well, why not? It's all relevant. It's sort of still interesting. And it's sometimes I'll forget and I'll be talking to a colleague. So recently, what, a couple of years ago, a year ago, I was talking to a colleague and she was saying, oh, about wanting to be on YouTube or something. I said, oh, yeah, well, I've got a tune in you. She said, have you? And I showed her and she said, that's got 30,000 views. And it's like, oh, you've written songs. And I was like, yeah, I kind of forgot I used to do that.
Yeah. You do kind of forget these things. That's right. I've written quite a lot of things that I've been trying to forget, to be quite honest.
But they just won't let you, damn it.
They won't let me go. They won't let me go. Anyway, this has been fantastic talking to you. Really interesting. So your book, The Weekend Fix, is out. Well, it's out today. And it is. Available from Amazon, I presume, and Sandstone Press.
Amazon, any bookstore, any independent bookshop that you want to order it from. Be available.
Yeah, that's
there.
Right. I mean,
Waterstones. If you must, Amazon as well. Yep.
Yeah, yeah. Good. I mean, they're obviously as we're speaking, bookshops are still closed, but a lot of them are doing online stuff, so you can order it. But I hope you booked as well, and it's been great talking to you. Thanks very much, Craig.
Well, thank you very much for giving the time to chat to me, John. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Bye.
Good. Bye.